You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2021 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 15, today we're in Andorra La Vella.
Where are we, Kate?
We're in Andorra.
Oh, yeah, any more detail than that? I'm looking forward to your architectural criticism of Andorra in tonight's episode.
Okay, yes.
Later on, though,
yes.
Unfortunately, we'll not be hearing your tale via tap. You were going to do that, but you've passed that responsibility back to me.
With many regrets. Yeah. I offer my condolences.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm sure you've got a lot to offer on the architectural front. I could see you taking it all in as we drove into Andorra. Very impressed by you in the car today. This is the last time you'll be joining us in the podcast.
Yes.
But we will be hearing your audio diary.
Yes, the last installment of my audio diary.
That's Kate Wagner. We're with Francois Thomazeau as well.
Hi there.
Hello, Francois.
Hello.
Kate, I was impressed by you today because as we were approaching Andorra, I said to you, Kate, do you have your visa for working in Andorra, your work visa ready? And you did not flicker at all.
No.
You just said, nice try. Shot you down like a dog, is what you said. I was very impressed by that. Anyway, you don't need a work visa, but we have left France. We are
yes.
in Andorra, and it does feel different, doesn't it? This is one reason why Lionel's not here anymore. He doesn't like Andorra. Francois, are you a fan?
I guess you get used to it. It's like, it's a lot like Monaco, like a cheap Monaco in the middle of the mountains, you know? Because at least, the architecture, I don't want to overlap on the... You know,
we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
But architecturally, it's pretty similar, and you've got the same luxury shops and boutiques, but only in Monaco you can't afford anything, whereas in Andorra, well, you can. You know, it's duty free, so people actually come here to buy cheap stuff. You know, so
well, we heard from Joe Laverick in last night's episode about how he loves Andorra, and obviously lots of riders love Andorra. 38 of them. Of the riders starting this Tour de France live in Andorra, and I'm sure they live here because they love it. They love its charms, its mountains, its lights. It's nothing to do with the tax situation here at all. But as we were driving into Andorra, we actually drove past Joe Laverick. I recognize his team kit, and he was standing outside an apartment block, which he said was home to 10 World Tour pros. And coming down the mountain into the capital here, we kept passing professional riders who were out training or going out to see the Tour de France. One of the other things, though, that I think scores against Andorra for me and for Lionel is that every time we're here, as you can probably hear, the traffic is horrendous in the capital city here. But that's partly because the Tour de France is here. If we were here outside of the Tour de France, it obviously wouldn't be as busy as it is. But you've always got a sense of it being very clogged up. Anyway, an exciting stage today. Let's hear all about what happened. Kate's not doing it. I will. We started in France in Serre, and we came up to Andorra La Vella.
We can share responsibility on this.
If you want.
Yeah.
Do you want to chip in?
Yeah, I'll chip in.
Well, it was stage 15, 191.5 kilometers. A really, really difficult stage. Lots and lots of climbing. And the first attacker of the day was Thomas de Gendt.
Yes.
Who else? What formed actually was not so much a breakaway, it was more a split in the peloton. Wout van Aert said at the finish he had not actually intended to go in the break and found himself there by accident. We did wonder about the Jumbo-Visma team tactics because they've of course only got 5 riders left in the race.
Yes.
Is this going to be your chip in? Are you going to agree?
Yeah, I'm going to chip in about Jumbo because okay. Obviously like I know the
ins and outs.
Yeah, the ins and outs. But it was interesting, yes, because they left Jonas Vingegaard, who is their GC guy, in the GC part of the peloton with only Mike Tunesson, which was kind of perplexing to me because I don't quite think they're the same size, so that if something happened to Jonas's bike,
yeah,
who's going to... Anyways, it seems like kind of an iffy move. But actually, I think things kind of coalesced as the time went on when they had all... Of course, like not to spoil what happened at the end, but... successful day for them.
The suspense
but
will
then,
be killing
at the same
listeners.
Time, you know, Wout came back to help yeah. Jonas in the end.
I'll get to that, Kate, obviously.
But
give me,
so it's
give me
like,
time.
Were they disorganized or was this actually just part of the plan or did have a road captain that was... This is actually quite an interesting question.
Bike racing is you can reverse engineer it.
That's so
and
true.
We can
Trust
now
me.
Sit back at the end of the day and reflect on a an absolute masterclass from Jumbo Visma, because they fought on three different fronts, and really, you can argue, came up trumps on all three fronts.
Exactly.
But we'll get to that. They had three riders in the breakaway, which, as you say, Kate, was perplexing with Jonas Vingegaard in the fight for the podium, left, I mean, with Mike Tunison, but you could say isolated behind.
Not with a climbing domestique, though. Not like Seb Kuss or
exactly.
Stefan Kleslake.
With Van Aert in that move at the front was Stephen Kruijswijk and Seb Kuss. From Team Ineos Grenadiers were Jonathan Castrovieco and Dylan Van Baarle. Dan Martin, Mike Woods were there from Israel Startup Nation. Vincenzo Nibali, Julien Bernard and Kenny Ellison from Trek Segafredo. Heard an amusing comment from a Belgian colleague of ours who had phoned Edward Toons the other night, and he was asked who he was sharing with. He said, Lo Squalo, the shark, to which Nibali apparently shouted across the room, I feel more like a goldfish in this Tour de France than a shark. So they were well represented in that front group. Julian Alaphilippe was there as well, another rider we fancy for the stage, Alejandro Valverde. Groupama FDJ, who've not done an awful lot in this Tour de France, maybe because a few of them, I think, have been suffering from stomach problems, including David Godu and Bruno Amirai. And I saw him in real pain at the end, actually.
Yeah, he looks rough.
To have PCR test, and he was doubled over with clutching his stomach and looked in a lot of pain, but he did an awful lot of work. I mean, there was a moment in the race where Groupama FDJ really took responsibility with Amirai and Valentin Madouas, who were obviously working to help David Godu try and win the stage. There were other riders there, including Nairo Quintana, obviously in the fight for the King of the Mountains jersey, as is Wout Poels, who was there too. And Michael Matthews was there to try and get points in the green jersey competition. So that was a big old group at the front. Behind that,
you forgot Bahrain Victorious.
I wasn't going to name everybody because it wasn't.
No,
a big
but
group.
There was. This is instrumental in the fight for the King of the Mountains.
Sorry, Kate.
Sorry.
You're right. Matej Moric was there. I think that's why you wanted me to
mention that. No, it's because Wout Poels was there and he sprinted for King of the Mountains. He's now in the King of the Mountains jersey because he sprinted. And
I think I said Wout Poels was there, didn't I? I did.
Yeah, but he
and
was there
so
with lots of other
was
people.
Dylan Toons.
Yes.
You're
he had help.
Right.
He had help.
Okay, so Frank Bonamour was there as well. I needed to say it.
Yeah, okay. I think we've covered... Oh, Sergio and I was there, and Pierre Latour was there.
Really?
So we've covered just about everybody.
There was a lot of people there.
There were a lot of people there.
But there were teams, small teamlets, let's say teamlets, up front that, you know, had instrumental roles.
Whose presence was significant.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. This is why you were going to do it. As I say, Groupama FDJ took control, and the gap went out to about 10 minutes. Behind... UAE Team Emirates seemed happy for them to go. The big Norwegian Vegard Stick Langen was a familiar presence at the front of the bunch. He led for a long, long time. Wow, it's really noisy here, isn't it? The main interest up front was the King of the Mountains competition. It's become a real focus of interest in this tour because we've got some really strong riders in contention for it. Mike Woods was in the jersey today. But he was being challenged by Wout Poels.
He was dethroned.
He was dethroned. Wout Poels, Nairo Quintana, and
Wout
Van
Aert,
surprisingly. And those, they were really going for it and knocking lumps out of each other. Van Aert, when it came to the sprints, was obviously pretty powerful. And he was the first over the Col de Puymoren. Puymoren?
Puymorens.
And he was first at the top of the Puy-Morans, ahead of Poels and Woods. Quintana made a big move on the Porte de Envalira, the highest climb of this Tour de France, and therefore the Henri de Grange prize for the first over the summit. He reached the top first. Really impressive attack. Windy conditions up there. He went over alone before Van Aert, Poels and Woods. A leading group of 17 formed on the descent. Guillaume Martin, meanwhile, second overall at the start of the day after being in the breakaway yesterday, he was starting to struggle and he could not hold on to the yellow jersey group behind. There was a big descent before a 6 kilometre climb and they called the Bechalis, which took the riders kind of, they came almost into the capital here, Andorra La Vella, and then up this climb and then another descent back into the capital. And it was a really interesting, quite short but very steep, lots of hairpins climb. And there was interest in front and behind. Quintana attacked that group, but it was Godu who followed him. He'd been set up, obviously. Then Sepp Kuss and Alejandro Valverde. And Kuss and Valverde emerged as the strongest on the climb. But Kuss spotted a weakness in Valverde, pressed home his advantage and got a little gap. He was about 25 seconds clear going over the summit. I fancied Valverde to perhaps catch him on the descent. He didn't. The gap kind of held the same. And Kuss came in to win the stage. Threw his sunglasses into the crowd, which was a nice gesture. A great win for him and a great win for Jumbo-Visma. Valverde held on for second ahead of Poles, Izaguirre and Guerrero, who finished in the minor placings. Behind them, we saw some really valiant attempts from Ben O'Connor, who's, after his stage win, has kind of yo-yoed a little bit. He had a go. Our audio diarist, of course, will no doubt hear his account of the stage in our next Kilometre Zero. I was very impressed by Jonas Vingegaard on the climb. He was taking it to Tadej Pogacar. Pogacar didn't really struggle, but nevertheless, they were having a go.
It was interesting because I made the joke to Richard. I said, and this was in reference to also to Itzulia Basque Country, where he did something similar. I said, may we all find someone who loves us like Jonas Vingegaard loves sucking the wheel of Tadej Pogacar.
Well, he did that, but he also had a go, and it was good to see. I mean, they're not scared to have a go. We even saw Rigoberto Urán have a go. We need to mention Ineos Grenadiers because, once again, they made the pace hard. They did manage to isolate Pogacar. Van Baarle and Castroviejo, who had been in the front group, dropped back to help with that effort. There's lots going on there. There's a fight for the podium as well as the fight to topple Pogacar, if that is indeed possible. But we saw all of those riders, Carapaz, Vingegaard, Urán, O'Connor, they all had a go today. Pogacar was pretty untouchable.
He was fine to let them fight.
Yeah. Martin was the big loser. He dropped 7 places, 9th overall. Pogacar remains in yellow. Rigoberto ran up to 2nd. Vingegaard up to 3rd. King of the Mountains. Poles is now in the polka dot jersey with Mike Woods 2nd. Quintana 3rd. And Van Aert, an accidental, so he says, 4th.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2021 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much indeed to Super Sapiens, our title sponsor. Very grateful to them for their support, of course. If you want to be in with a chance of winning 3 months worth of Super Sapiens sensors, which you stick on your upper arm and they wear it for 2 weeks and they track your blood glucose levels, you can watch that in real time on your phone on the Super Sapiens app. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com and you'll see how to enter the competition. All we want from you is 60 seconds or less of audio telling us how and why you would use Super Sapiens, perhaps to help you fulfill your cycling ambition. Let's hear from another entrant now.
Hi guys, this is Will from Pennsylvania. I've got a lot going on these days in my life. I'm a father to 2 foster children, with our first biological baby on the way. I'm completing a PhD, and I work a 6-day-a-week job. On top of this, I am training for the Dirty Dozen, a race that's held every October in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, up the 13 steepest climbs in the city. With so much on my plate, it can be hard to get high-quality training in, and being able to use the Super Sapiens products to understand how I can best fuel for these rides would sure make a big difference as I prepare for this task in October. Thank you so much. Keep up the great work.
Well, good luck in the competition. And as I say, if you would like to enter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. There's also still time to send in a question for our press conference episode tomorrow, where Francois and I will be joined by Mitch Docker, the EF Education Nepo rider, who will be joining us for the final week of the Tour de France. We've had lots of questions in, actually, but if you've got one, email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. If you have a question for Kate, we will get that question to Kate.
Thank you.
I'm sure she would love to answer your questions.
I would be very
well.
Happy, and I can submit my responses in audio.
Well, that would be good. That would be good. Yeah.
In writing, three copies.
Or we can just we can just ask you.
And notarized.
So listen, Jumbo Visma were the talk of the day. I was messaging our friend Brian Nygaard, who joins us at the Giro, of course, a proud Dane, and he has been quite unhappy, it's fair to say, at the way that Jumbo Visma have ridden in support or not in support of Jonas Vingegaard, who, in the absence of Primoz Roglic, has emerged as Jumbo Visma's main GC contender. You know, I suggested last week that they were deliberately playing down his chances in order to remove pressure from him, not put pressure on him, and perhaps to somehow implicitly put pressure on Pogacar. I don't think that's now the case. It is like they are fighting this tour on different fronts. They're not. It's not all for Vingegaard, certainly. Van Aert, however, you know, at the finish, he did say that he didn't mean to go in the breakaway, that once he was there he thought he would go for the King of the Mountains points because he was there and he might as well. He also said that his coach is not in favour of him riding the tour the way that he is, making it really hard for himself with Tokyo and the Olympics coming up. He doesn't think he should be digging so deep in chasing stage wins, King of the Mountains points, etc, etc. And he said that he sort of disagrees, that he thinks he needs as hard a 3 weeks as he can possibly get, which is what he's giving himself. I mean, I was surprised to see him going full gas for these King of the Mountains points today.
Yeah.
Well, actually, at the finish, he also said something. I know that usually strategies are actually decided, you know, afterwards, after the stage.
Exactly.
You know, you look back and you say, that's what we're trying to do, when actually in real action, you know, you have no plans whatsoever. But what Van Aert suggested, that the fact that he had three guys up the road meant that one could, you know, wait for Jonas Vingegaard in case of trouble. They didn't have to do that. But if you look at what Ineos Grenadiers did, they actually did that. Castroviejo and who was
Van Baarle.
And Van Baarle actually stopped at the top of the climb to wait for the Carapaz group. So obviously this was a planned move from Ineos Grenadiers. So there's no reason to not believe that Jumbo-Visma had this option in mind as well, that having three guys in the front meant one could let himself get dropped in case of trouble and go back to help Jonas Vingegaard. So in which case, whatever, the outcome is what it is. We saw Wout Van Aert, you know, battle it out in the climbs for the polka dot jersey, and we saw Sepp Kuss go for a stage victory. So in the end, Vingegaard always in the same place, in third, looking like one of the most serious, you know, rivals for Pogacar. Sepp Kuss wins the second stage win for Jumbo-Visma in this race, and in the end, almost a perfect scenario for Jumbo-Visma.
This is perhaps controversial, but I think Jonas Vingegaard is kind of built up of the same composition and the same kind of disposition as Tadej Pogacar, in that he's very calm, very level-headed, very much an aggressive rider who stays in the wheel of who he needs to stay in the wheel of. And so they're probably more comfortable leaving him to do that than maybe someone like Roglic, who has sort of a more strategic / team oriented way of controlling things. It's just kind of interesting to see, maybe perhaps it's like a generational thing.
I think it's more that he doesn't probably feel that he's earned his stripes. I watched his body language at the finish. We'll hear from him in a moment. I watched Grisha Neerman come in and give him embrace him and say, you know, great job. And
he wasn't...
You know, Van Aert, the way that they spoke. I don't think Vingegaard himself has any issue. I think he is sort of pinching himself at the position that he's in. He doesn't feel entitled to...
Yes.
...deny, you know, to clip the wings of Van Aert or Sepp Kuss. And like I say, we can look back now on a phenomenally successful day for Jumbo-Visma, but they gambled. I mean, they did gamble.
They gambled hugely.
It's okay. It's fine to have two riders up the road, but you know, Sepp Kuss is a guy who could have been a great ally for Vingegaard in the yellow jersey group.
Absolutely.
If he's 10 minutes up the road and Vingegaard has a puncture or needs a bike change, that's no good that Sepp Kuss is 10 minutes up the road.
What would have been the point to have Sepp Kuss, Wout van Aert and Steven Kruijswijk in the yellow jersey group helping Vingegaard?
I mean, it's a more conventional tactic, I suppose.
It is. But
it's
a conservative tactic rather than an aggressive one.
What's
conservative tactics for third place in Paris? Yeah. I mean, this is...
So now we think Jumbo-Visma did the right thing.
I don't think Jumbo-Visma main goal these days is...
Stage wins.
Of course it's stage wins. It's not GC position. So they went for the stage win, which is what every team wants. And if, you know, on top of it, Jonas Vingegaard finishes on the podium in Paris, then fair enough.
Well, let's hear from Vingegaard at the finish. Let's hear what he said.
I tried a few times, and it seemed like nobody was stronger than the other in the favorite group today. So, but at least I tried, and I came in together with the best guys, and there's still two really hard mountain stages left. So I'll do my best. It's a bit of changing mindset when Primoz went out of the tour, I think I'm growing into it. Yeah. I didn't expect to be like, especially on the Mont Ventoux stage. I didn't expect to be having that great feeling, especially in the second week. Take it day by day, and we'll see what the result is gonna be in the end. If it's a podium, it's a podium, and if it's a 10th place, it's a 10th place.
So. It's gonna be pressure for you, though.
No, I take it easy, and we'll see what it's gonna be.
How was it to be in that group today with all the attacks?
Hard. It was going fast, and it was attack on attack, so it was a bit stop and go. And of course, it's also nice to be there.
And so, what did Van Aert say to you when you just saw each other after the race?
Yeah, he said congrats with the win of Sepp. So that's really, really nice. And I guess we're gonna celebrate a little bit tonight. As you say, the first week was probably one of the worst you could have. We lost Primoz, we lost three guys, we lost also Robert and also Tony, but we lost our main GC guy, so we lost pretty much everything, but we're fighting back, and as you say, it's going well, we have two stage wins now, so we'll keep going. If I would have any problems, then I had two guys out the front and they will wait for me, I never felt like I was in any bad situation.
That was Jonas Vingegaard, very happy, and I think he should be happy because he looks strong. He's prepared to take it to Pogacar. When he attacks, I'm not saying he puts Pogacar in difficulty, but he looks sprightly. You know, he's obviously recovering well. He's going well. I did laugh though at the finish because some of the teams tonight were having to basically 100 meters beyond the finish line. Oh, look at that. There's a metaphor. A Jumbo-Visma car on a breakdown lorry. I mean, it would have been a great metaphor if they'd had a bad day. But as it is, it's not a great metaphor. Anyway, that'll be Daniel off to find the football, no doubt, in a pub. He's looked to be a man in a hurry. Yeah, 100 meters beyond the finish line, there was a tent with PCR tests, COVID tests, for some teams. And after hauling their asses 200 kilometers over the mountains, 4,500 meters of climbing, some of them had to go for a COVID test immediately, including Vingegaard, who emerged from the tent shaking his head as though he'd had his brain tickled, which is a feeling that we can relate to those of us who had these horrible COVID tests. But yeah, I mean, he seems to be perfectly relaxed about the situation. An interesting little contrast. I mean, another rider fighting for the podium and up to second overall now is Rigoberto Urán. And we did see Urán attack.
Which is very rare.
Which is quite rare. But he also, two of his teammates were up the road in the
Nielsen
breakaway.
Paulus.
Nielsen Paulus and Ruben Guerrero, who rode very well again. I spoke to Paulus at the finish and asked him whether, you know, there's obviously a parallel there between, I mean, EF have got more riders still in the race, but the fact that those guys are being allowed to go up in those kind of moves is quite interesting too.
Yeah. It's been a pattern on this tour, which is quite interesting. We've had the breakaway, but usually in Grand Tour breakaways, you really have with no ambitions whatsoever. You know, the breakaways we've had in this tour have always been massively impressive with guys
strong,
who could have been GC contenders, guys with ambitions for the polka dot jerseys, guys with real, who are really worth. I mean, Pokémon Lema Sepp Kuss. These are not guys who have that day. You know, there are guys who amply deserve to know that these guys can win and will win Grand Tour stages. So the pattern in this tour has been really exciting. And most of the teams, it's funny because you've got this small little yellow jersey group of about 10 guys, you know, like 5 or 6 minutes down. And at the front, every team, and including the GC teams, have 2 or 3 guys, which is very interesting.
I think it speaks to just how strong and how dominant Pogacar is. He's got a 5-minute lead on everyone else. At a certain point, if you want to walk away with this from this tour with something, you have to put guys in the breakaway. You have to take risks. You have to do those things. And it paid off for Jumbo today, but it easily couldn't have.
Yeah, I mean, there's some very strong riders who are still in the hunt for something out of this tour, and that's why they're going for stages. I mean, Dan Martin said he thought it was the strongest break there'd ever been at the Tour de France. I put that to Nielsen Paulus at the finish.
Well, up the road today, how was that in that that move of big hitters?
Super tough. As soon as I came up into the breakaway, I could tell that it was going to be a really, really hard day. And honestly, the headwinds on the last couple climbs did make it a bit easier. But over the top of Envalira and then Bechelis were just incredible. The pace was so high. And I mean, I spent a lot of time up here in Andorra. I have an apartment in Soldeu. I'm a resident here, and I knew the climb super well. And that is by far the fastest I've ever gone up these climbs. It was insane.
It's interesting. Your team and Jumbo Visma obviously got guys placed highly overall, but also men in the break as well. Is that just a sign of how far Pogacar is ahead of everybody else, that you're allowed to go for your own ambitions as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think no matter what position you're in, even if Rigo was only a few seconds behind Pogacar and GC, I think that it's just in our interest to be in the breakaway too if we need to come back, because we wouldn't be able to follow Rigo and pull him off the front to get away from Pogacar in the stage. So if he does that on his own and we're ahead and then we're up there to help him, then that's just a clever strategy if you can pull it off. Yeah.
So will we see more of that in the final week?
Yeah, we hope. All we can do is just keep racing our bikes and focus on our race and hope that Rigo just continues to stay solid.
Well, that was Nielsen Paulus, the EF Education Nippo rider. I also spoke to Mark Donovan, the team DSM rider, making his debut at the Tour de France. He rode the Vuelta last year. He found himself in that very distinguished company today in that big breakaway. They've had a really tough tour, team DSM, but he seemed quite happy at the finish.
Well, Dan Martin just said he thought that was the strongest break there'd ever been in the Tour de France. Is that what it felt like?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, looking around when it sort of formed, I was like, oh God, about half of these guys can win today or more. Yeah, it was pretty crazy, crazy strong break. I was lucky, I felt really good on the start, and I knew I had to go full just to get in there. But yeah, it was nice, and I felt good all day, but just didn't have the legs on the final climb, and then actually had a bit of unlucky, got a puncher as well, a slow puncher. So that took a while, had to change my bike. So it wasn't ideal, but it didn't really change much in the end. But
how were the conditions there? It was a hot day and a strong wind as well.
Yeah, it was just constantly ice on the back of the neck, water all the time. It was kind of nice being in the break because the car's only a few metres behind you all the time. And then, yeah, it was. There was a period of time when, after the break first formed, when we turned onto the main road, there was a few attacks going and no one really wanted to take control. But then luckily FDJ took control and they just battled away into a headwind all day. So that was kind of nice for everyone else.
Who impressed you? I mean, in the break, obviously a lot of big names and strong riders, but who particularly impressed you?
Well, I got to say the two French guys who worked for Gourdou, Amirai. Yeah. He was in both the breaks I've been in the Vuelta as well, and then also Madouas as well. They both just pulled all day. And then, yeah, I think everyone else was just pretty happy to sit in the wheels, to be honest.
How are you feeling 2 weeks into your first Tour de France?
Yeah, I felt really good today, actually. I was really motivated for it. Had a bit of unlucky, you know, I've tried to get in a break so many times that it's just not quite worked out, but today it really did. And hopefully, going into the final week, I can, yeah, kind of build on this.
Lots more chances in the third week.
Yeah, definitely the first half of the first week. I think some of them will be some big GC fights, but yeah, for sure. I mean, got nothing to lose, so might as well try.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2021 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, our longtime sponsor. We have been running our Super Sunday competition. Lionel is in charge of administering that. Guess the winner of Sunday's stage, that's today. And if your name is drawn out, the Cycling Podcast casket, you will win £80 worth of Science and Sport goodies. Lionel has not let me know yet whether anybody named Sepp Kuss as a potential winner. I'm sure they did, so I'm sure we'll have a winner. But I'll probably say who it is in tomorrow night's episode. You can enter the competition by going to thecyclingpodcast.com and you'll see the details there about how to guess who will win next Sunday's stage in Paris. And, well, maybe it will be Mark Cavendish because he survived today's stage. If you want 25% off your Science and Sport goodies, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code Kate.
Kate is sleeping, so I'll say
Kate's looking at something.
SISCP25.
Kate's checking something on her phone. Looking forward to your architectural highlights and lowlights of Andorra, Kate. But yeah, Cavendish made it. Another tough day for him. He was off the back quite early, got back on, well looked after by Michael Morkov and Tim de Klerk and others.
He lost another rival today, Nasser Bouhanni.
Nasser Bouhanni.
Finishing on the podium, well, a few times on this Tour de France. He abandoned, as they say. So, yeah, I mean, once again, if the more Cav gets near Paris, the less opposition he will have on the last day.
He was, yeah, Bouhanni was struggling in front of the broom wagon for a little bit and eventually called it a day. A shame, because it's actually one of the stories of the Tour which we were going to cover at some point, the rebirth of Bouhanni. I mean, we've been so focused on Cavendish, but Bouhanni has also, you know, been really close to a stage win at this Tour, back to probably his best, which is kind of gone. It's a story that's gone untold in a way. Maybe we'll ask Connor Swift, our diarist, for a bit more about Bouhanni and his Tour, but he's out of the race now, sadly. Well, today, I mean, stage win for Sepp Kuss, a guy who has often promised a result like this. You know, it's another classic case. If Roglic was still in the race, he wouldn't have been in a position to win the stage. It's something he's looked capable of for a long time. But when the responsibility has been given to him, he's sometimes struggled to deliver.
Yes.
You know, when he's been given team leadership or when he's been given opportunities. He really took it today, and I was really impressed with the way that he held off Valverde, a wily old fox.
There was an interesting pattern again. It actually kind of explains what I was saying before about the new patterns with these breakaway groups with lots of strong guys in there. There's really been a divide now, I think, in teams and between the GC, the real GC guys. I mean the real GC guys, not the guys who might have a chance to one day become a GC rider, and the guys who might have the potential to be GC riders but who don't have the mind for it and go for stage wins. I think that's the case for Sepp Kuss. If you don't give him too much responsibilities, if you don't put too much burden on his shoulders and he goes for the stage wins,
he can just go.
It's the case with, I had a long interview for a Figaro with Pierre Roland, and Pierre Roland told me that the first 5 or 6 years of his career had been a nightmare because he was considered as a potential GC contender, being the best young rider in 2011. And the 5 years that followed, he said, were a nightmare. You're under pressure every day. You're fearing a crash. You're fearing to let your teammates down. And he said the day when Jonathan Vaughters told him, forget the GC, go for stage wins, if he was a newborn rider and enjoyed the job again. I think that most of the guys we had at the front are that type of riders. You know, they're great riders. They can win a stage, a major Grand Tour stage, but they're not GC riders. Sepp Kuss is absolutely this type of rider.
Absolutely.
I had a message from Lizzie Banks to say, nice to finally see Sepp Kuss trying. Now he looks like the rest of us when we are not trying. Because I've said on the podcast before that it just often looks so easy for Sepp Kuss. When he's been lieutenant to Roglic, there have been moments where he's sort of, you know, Roglic has been struggling to hold his wheel, and Kuss is just riding on air.
Yeah.
You know, he looks so sublime.
He's liberated his task of servitude.
He's a classic climber, you know, who, when things are going well for him and he's riding well, it just looks so, so easy for him. And this is a success that has been a long time coming. He lives in Andorra. He's one of the many who lives in Andorra. He said his girlfriend was on the climb and her parents. I think she's from Barcelona, and that was inspiration for him today. Dan Martin was actually very emotional at the finish, talking about his wife and twin daughters being near the finish as well. So, yeah, he really choked up talking about that. We're seeing a really interesting battle for the King of the Mountains, a kind of long discredited competition. It's been like a consolation prize. Either you know, a rider on the podium has won it almost by accident, or it's been won by somebody, a modest rider, really targeting it. What we're seeing here are there are really four: Quintana, Poels, Woods, and Van Aert. You know, battling out four real quality riders,
powerhouses.
Yeah, and it's adding luster to this competition. It's one of the real interesting points in the race now.
Yeah, there's mountains until Wednesday. Almost Thursday. So most of the last week will still be mountains. So more excitement on the hills, on the climbs, and given that now it's one of the most interesting competitions, and that all these guys and all these teams are going for it, I'm sure we'll have really animated races from the start. And the kind of script we had today is probably going to be reproduced in the future stages, which is rather exciting.
Well, I spoke to the man now in the polka dot jersey, Wout Poels, at the finish. Here's what he had to say.
Quite a battle we're seeing for the King of the Mountains jersey.
Yeah. It was a battle.
It's probably the most exciting part of the race at the moment. You're in the jersey just now. I mean, a good day for you today.
Yeah, no, I'm really happy with it. It was a goal to get the jersey back, and we made it. But still, everything's really close, so we have to be focused and 6 more days of racing. 6 more days full gas, and then hopefully we can keep it.
Mike Wood said last night, you know, how much those efforts cost you at the top of the mountain. It's almost as if you have to decide between going for the jersey or going for the stage win. Is that how you feel as well?
Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, every spin is like maybe 20-30 seconds. And if you do 5 on a day, at the end you are sprinting 2 minutes full gas. And then in the final climb, maybe you come a little bit short. But the thing is, if I want to go for the mountain jersey, you have to make sacrifices. And that means you have to sprint. And it also doesn't make it easier that Van Aert starts to sprint. So, yeah, this is what it is.
Who's the biggest rival, do you think, for the jersey?
I think Van Aert, Woods, Quintana. Depends also with the mountaintop finish. You get a lot of points. What UAE, if they keep in giving the stage away, or Pogacar goes himself for it.
Final question. When we get to Paris, would you rather have had a stage win or be in the King of the Mountains jersey?
Both.
Well, that was Wout Poels, the man in the polka dot jersey. Interesting, you know, to see Van Aert going for it, and he was sort of looking back on that with a rueful expression, because you know it's funny to see a sprint at the top of a climb between Van Aert, Poels, Woods, Quintana. I don't think he's going to be a realistic contender for that, and I was puzzled as to why he was putting so much into snaffling up those points. Really could be proven wrong, of course. While it's still there, I think he just wants to keep himself in contention. But yeah, Poels, it was interesting what he said about the how much those efforts take out of you. Mike Wood said the same last night. These guys do really have to make a choice now, King of the Mountains or a stage win, although they all say they still want both. I mean, another rider today you want to mention, Francois, is the old dog, Alejandro Valverde. I was watching on French TV, and they were quite confident that Valverde would come back to Kuss on the
descent. Yeah, well, Jalabert was, I mean, he's kind of the same generation, I was about to say. And Jalabert, for various reasons, having raced in Spain and having been in that environment, he's obviously a great fan of Alejandro Valverde. I mean, there were 2 points I wanted to make. So in French, Andorre la Vieille means, actually, phonetically, means put the old lady to sleep, you know? But obviously,
old Yeller style.
Yeah, obviously, this stage, you know, didn't put the old man to sleep, because he came very close to, you know that Eddie made it. Eddie beaten Kuss to the line and won the stage. I said that about Greipel the other day as well. But I mean, this Valverde came close. He would have been the second oldest winner of a Tour de France stage after Pino Cerami. I say Pino Cerami, and not Cerami in Italian, because he was Belgian, in case you know you forget. So yeah, 41 and something would have been made in the second oldest win over Tour de France stage. The other little thing I wanted to say is about Guillaume Martin, who lost time, and his second place only lasted 1 day, like Ben O'Connor after Le Grand Bornand. If you look at the GC tonight, it's actually, well, got back to normal. It's exactly the same as 2 days before, with Guillaume Martin in the same spot, but he's closer than he was to the front. He was 9-something down 2 days ago. He's now 7-something down, and actually he made a kind of a break in 9th place, you know, because Bilbao is now a long way away. So probably Martin, you know, he seems to be out for his best GC results. So I mean, he can't be too disappointed about what happened today.
We move on to architecture, Kate. Now, we drove into Andorra and these dark stone kind of dominates the apartment blocks as we came down the hill into the capital. What are your impressions, though? You're an award-winning, globally revered architecture critic.
What awards have I won?
I don't know.
I haven't actually won any awards. No, but I did give a keynote lecture at Yale, which I guess counts.
Done a TED Talk as well.
That's true.
Well, that makes you a real authority.
Yes, of course. But so I would say with architecturally, it's funny because remember when we were in Tignes, we talked about how ugly Tignes was, which it is. I mean, Tignes is like overblown chalets. Chalets inflated to the size of apartment buildings, which is not a chalet and should not be interpreted as a chalet and should not be imitated.
Are they
McChalets? McChalets. But I would say that with Andorra, it's a little bit interesting because it was like Francois said, it's like the glitzy architecture of Monaco, but mixed with kind of a ski lodge vibe. And it's all governed by this really dark stone that is endemic to the region, which, you know, can be quite lovely, you know, as a floor or something. But when every building is covered in it, it does create this kind of closed-in oppressive effect. At the same time, Andorra just kind of feels like a big tax-free mall in the middle.
That's what it is.
In the middle. No, but in the middle of these, like, resplendent mountains. It's so funny to me to see, like, Forever 21 architecture or H&M architecture as instead of, you know, like, old, beautiful, resplendent ancient things. And so it's this kind of mix of, like, high-tech, high-gloss, tourist living mixed with a kind of penchant for the outdoors that doesn't quite penetrate the surface like it does in Tignes, where it's very clear that everyone in Tignes is doing outdoors tourism. They're skiing, they're cycling, they're whatever. But here, that kind of frosts beneath the surface, and that's why it looks more like a mall. It's not about a historic place. It's not about placemaking. It kind of can be anywhere were it not for this vernacular stone that exists, that actually gives it its regional quality, that actually gives it this aura of a place that exists and its own kind of weird architectural style. And also, everything is new. It's like brand new. It's like curtain wall, ground floors, granite, tile, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s new.
Yeah, it's funny because if you look at they really, really work hard on that tourism side, and in all their leaflets and, you know, publicity, they really advertise the old heritage they have. It's true that they have very beautiful 12th, 11th and 12th century Romanesque
churches and stuff, yeah.
And they make a big fuss of it, and you know, so obviously they try. They must realize that the general architecture is a little bit too, how could I say, transatlantic or transcontinental or whatever you can call it.
I guess you could call it global or
Global or something.
I would say faceless.
Yeah, because of it, they make a real, you know, you can tell they make lots of publicity for their churches. I guess that was
an ambulance.
No, there was a local fireman late for the football match, I suppose. Anyways, yeah. Well, obviously English guys or Italian guys. A little culture.
Is there some culture, Francois?
Well, not all of it will be on Andorra. There's lots. There's actually lots of.
We're having our photograph taken by an actual photographer here, an award-winning photographer.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about Andorra a lot. That of course, there is culture here, of course, but we overlooked totally Serré, the place where we started from today. And actually, if you happen to be in the area, which is French Catalonia, Serré is an amazing little place. It's called the Mecca of Cubism.
A fan of Kate just walked past and shouted out her Twitter moniker. That was quite extraordinary. Anyway, sorry, Francois.
Okay, I'll be back. Yeah, it's not exactly architecture, but yeah. So
I can't live here.
Serré is called the Mecca of Cubism. It sounds strange, but actually, it's a little town, a very little town, but in the early 20th century, the guys, you know, Cubist painters, they were looking for a place to go on holidays, and they ended up in Serre. And this guy were called Deodato Sévrac, Frank Bertie Avillon, and Manolo Hugué. And they found a place so great, they asked a good friend of theirs to come to Serre to spend holidays with them. His name's guy was Pablo Picasso. And so after Picasso went there, you had Juan Gris, Kisling, Picabia, Dunoyer de Segonzac, Lot Soutine, Chagall, all these guys, Dubuffet, Dufy, all these guys came to live in Serre and paint. Later you had also poets like Max Jacob or Guillaume Apollinaire. And so this place, this little village, became actually known as the Mecca of Cubism because for decades, lots of very, very world-famous painters went to Serre to just spend good time, drink Catalan wine, have fun, and paint. And as the result, you have a big museum now in Serre with works by all these guys. So, you know, very unlikely place for, to be a kind of a stronghold of the greatest painters of the 20th century, but there you are. So if you happen to be in the area, well, don't miss Serre and don't miss the museum. It's really a nice place to go. Cheese of the day. So, well, for all of you who've been on holidays in Catalonia and down to Barcelona know, have tried Mato, you know. Mato is a fresh cheese. It's sometimes made of cow's milk, sometimes made of goat's milk, with no salt added, and it's usually served with honey. And it's now a kind of a traditional emblematic Catalan dessert known as Meli Mato on lots of menus. If you go to anywhere in Catalonia or in Barcelona, on the menu you'll find Meli Mato, and it's it's one of the which between Mato and honey, which is simple and really tasty. Very tasty, as someone would say.
Very nice. That's my catchphrase, Francois.
We won't go back to Andorra being the capital of one of the new capitals of cycling, and the reasons why it had become the kind of a capital of cycling for many pro riders. I mean, as I said, I probably already yesterday when I asked Matt White about it, he said, "Tax heaven." So well, if he says it, well, it's probably true. There was a curious fact of the day on the stage today. The peloton rode at kilometer 50 through a little town called Prades, and the mayor of this little town was totally unknown like three years ago, and it's called Jean Castex, and it was named by President Macron, the man in charge of the fight against COVID-19, and it did so well, at least in Macron's view, that he's now the French Prime Minister. He has been since July 2020, and the funny thing about Castex and the fight against COVID-19 is when he became Prime Minister in July 2020, in September was in Christian Prudhomme's car in Tour de France, and he was forced to stay out of action for more than a week because Christian Prudhomme was tested positive for COVID.
And he was on the race today, Jean Castex. He wasn't put off, obviously, by that experience.
Well, we'll see tomorrow, you know.
It was just before a rest day the last year as well, wasn't it, when he joined the race?
Yeah, absolutely. So, this little-known mayor of a small town in the area is now the French Prime Minister. That was a curious fact of the day. Now for the song of the day.
Well, will we play out with the song of the day? Before we do, let's hear a little bit from Andorra. Well, he's not a resident, but he's been here for a few weeks. We heard from him last night. Joe Laverick, who is also keeping an audio diary for us this year, which is being released as a friend special. Two other writers, Red Walters and Marjolein van Geloof, are also keeping audio diaries, and we've released two of their episodes already for friends of the podcast. If you want to sign up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. But here's Joe's account of his day watching the Tour de France today.
Vive le Tour. What an incredible event it is to go and watch the Tour. I mean, it's everything you expect and more. It truly is a circus, and especially in Andorra, it shuts the whole country. So I rode up the Bechelis, awesome atmosphere, absolutely incredible, hundreds, thousands of people. And I got like 50 meters to the top and was turned around, which was a bit of a problem because then the police weren't letting us ride down. So I'd ride 150 meters, get told off by the police, I get told to walk, then I'd ride, wait till they're out of sight, ride another 200 meters, and just repeat that over and over again until I got to the bottom. Went down into Andorra la Vella to try and watch it there. Realised it's quite difficult to watch it from a good viewpoint near the finish line without one of those special yellow lanyards, which Richard and co have, and I unfortunately don't. So I went back to the bottom of Bechelis and ended up watching it with a couple of the Ineos Grenadier staff, which was... It was nice to, like, chat to some English guys and just yeah, like, the tour. I mean, everything. It's everything. You don't see this side of a bike race. When you're competing, you don't understand that roads are closed hours before. You've got to plan in advance where you want to be. I mean, I feel like I could write a whole, like, article on a guide to watching the Tour de France. I mean, I'm such a rookie. I messed so many things up. I didn't take drinks. I didn't take water. That's the same thing. I didn't take food, sorry. There's just so many things. But to see how quick they came past was... it's just another league. It's Le Tour. But then it's the little things. There's four helicopters always in the sky. There's, I don't know, a million and one motorbikes. And then the caravan. I've never seen a caravan in my life. I was kind of like a kid. But yeah, I rode back up. And then the team cars are coming up to the hotels up here. And kind of Action is a relatively recognisable jersey. So I was getting like beats from the team cars as I was going. And it's just, I mean, I kind of live in it. Like I raced a lot of these World Tour teams. But there's a part of me which was just like, Joe 3 years ago would have found this insanely cool. And to be honest, Joe in 2021 still finds it cool. Funnily enough, the caravan's actually parked in a massive car park outside my apartment. So I can see all that. But now, yeah, sorry, Richard did invite me to record tonight's episode of the Cycling Podcast, but I'm afraid I've got a date with football coming home. So, sorry, Richard, but certain things do take priority over the Cycling Podcast. England is one of those. Sorry.
Joe Laverick there. Well, we're about to say goodbye again to Kate. Kate's speechless. Kate, are you still there?
Tears in her eyes.
I truly am sad, except for the fact that I will see you in the mix zone literally every single day.
We'll see you every day, and we're going to hear from you in your audio diaries.
So it's not goodbye, and no. We will not be saying goodbye after the Tour de France
either. Of course not. You're part of the Cycling Podcast family now, as well as a friend, of course.
I am beyond honored, considering just a few months ago I was listening to the Cycling Podcast as a friend of the podcast, with my when I made my illustrations.
I hope you are a friend of the podcast. I'm going to check that you're a
friend. You can
of the
find
podcast.
My. Go through it our might records. Be under my birth name.
Oh yeah, now it's all coming
which
out.
Which is
yeah.
not Kate.
Oh
as
right.
you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, Kate. It's been wonderful having you, and we've had two episodes already of your audio diaries, both absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, be excited for the third one because it's actually a reflection on my time here at the Tour de France, which
well, it's been great so far, and they've had a phenomenal reaction from listeners. So
I'm very excited. It's been wonderful.
You've been a great asset.
We've enjoyed
your company. Enough of this.
I know this is so sappy.
No, it is. Yeah,
we're all so hungry.
This is not my style.
Yeah, and so before you go, Kate, I will need you.
I can't sing. Sorry.
A little bit. You know, I'm going to sing this line here, and you just have to say the end of it.
Taxman.
Okay. So.
Taxman.
Oh, I know.
Okay.
So
that's the song.
Excellent. Okay, play us out, Francois.
Let
and
me
Kate.
Tell you how ill will be.
Taxman.
There's one for you, 19 for me.
Taxman.
Cause I'm the taxman. Yeah, I'm the taxman. Should 5% appear too small?
Taxman!
Be thankful I don't take it all.
Taxman!
Cause I'm the taxman. Yeah, I'm the taxman. And you're working for no one but me.
Taxman!
On this Thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you.
Hang on, guys. What's this got to do with Andorra?
No idea.